What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Go Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello, welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper, the podcast series where we have lengthy, but I hope really interesting conversations with guests from business, entertainment, sports and politics, all with the support of Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. You move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles, building your fleet to your expectations. Visit wvfs.ie/business. And don't forget that Volkswagen Financial Service Business is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So today's guest, Rena Maycock, is somebody who I met recently for the first time, as you'll hear where during this conversation. But I was familiar with the excellent career she has had as an entrepreneur. So today we're going to talk about things like child protection technology, which she's very involved in with a really big idea present. That's towards the end of this interview. You'll also hear about her intro matchmaking service, which is an old-fashioned matchmaking business brought into the 21st century. We'll talk about her career in radio, which is where it all started, with a particular emphasis on sales. And we're also going to talk about drink, a type of drink you may not have tasted before, but which she is making with a hope to making it big in Ireland and Europe. So I hope you enjoy Rena Maycock. So, Rena Maycock, we're going to talk about matchmaking. We're going to talk about radio. We're going to talk about child protection. But I should say the reason I met you recently was at UCC Food and Beverage Conference, and you're going into the drink business with, of all things, an alcoholic kombucha. Now, isn't that counterintuitive? Isn't kombucha supposed to be some sort of health drink rather than something that you add alcohol into?
Technically, but isn't everything better with booze in it? Yeah, I'm an investor in this new startup called Combera, which is it's following the well-established trend in the States, actually, of people looking for better for you alcohol. So in the States, I believe the only growth alcoholic beverages are alcoholic kombucha and spritzers, seltzers, like White Claw, that kind of thing. But it hasn't taken hold in Europe yet. There's one other hard kombucha producer in Europe, and that is it.
Why is that, do you think? Could it have anything to do with the taste of kombucha?
Well, it's very polarizing indeed. And they did realize this in the States, actually, when they started this hard kombucha thing. And they realized that the natural flavor of kombucha, which I personally hate, is really polarizing. So they knew that they needed to completely overpower the natural flavor of kombucha with flavoring. So that's exactly what I've done.
So it's not kombucha.
It's kombucha, but it doesn't taste like it.
Okay, well, what the hell do you add into it?
Tastes like a delicious drink. So we're going for the kind of picnic market. So people that want to buy
a picnic market.
It's people that want to buy a little six pack and go down to the park and say.
That sounds like growing up with drinking cider out of tins of behind the field or behind the bush in the field.
Back in the day, good old times. Yeah, so that's the market that we're going for. It's people that want to be healthier, they want to live a better lifestyle. ABC One's middle class, mainly women, they do yoga, it's Circa, that's 32, has had her first baby and she's thinking, I'd love to give up booze, but I really love my Prosecco, don't like the taste of beer, seltzers don't taste like anything. So it's Circa that we want as our customer. She does yoga, she wants to be healthy, wants to give up booze, but not quite enough to actually do it.
How did you get into this?
It actually was suggested to us by our brother-in-law who lives in, or my brother-in-law rather, he lives in Sausalito. And when he came home to Ireland, he couldn't get it anywhere. And he was thinking, why is nobody doing this?
Your brother-in-law is not a 32-year-old yoga participant who's just had a baby.
No, he's a 47-year-old startup founder that's just had two babies. But he's been doing this for 10 years and all of his very wealthy friends are partaking in it.
Drinking this stuff. And he saw an opportunity here for Ireland. Yeah. So then how do you go about, you have the idea, how do you go about manufacturing this and bringing it to market, distributing it, all the rest of it?
Well, we have no domain expertise, myself and Fergal, my husband, who are investors in this. So we sought a friend of ours who is an expert in this. His name is John Power, and he has a company called Bearer Gin. From Castletown Bear, and Fergal's family are all from Castletown Bear, so that's the kind of the provenance. And we said, look, we don't know how to do this. You tell us how to do this, and we'll row in beside you. I've got a certain amount of sales and marketing expertise. I've run companies. Fergal has sales and marketing expertise as well, and John is the domain expert in booze. So we bought a secondhand brewery, truly sustainable, which investors love.
Brewery or distillery?
Brewery. Yeah, okay. It's like beer. It's brewed like beer.
Oh, see, because
so
I was
it's
thinking,
fermented tea.
I was thinking more along the lines of, there's distilleries popping up all over the country, doing gins as an interim measure towards getting to whiskey and stuff like that. Mm. So you went and found a brewery.
A brewery, yeah, because it's tea. You make it like tea. It's done with what's called a SCOBY or a mother, which is effectively an organism that you put into regular, say, Barry's tea in an enormous vat. You do that for 7 days and then you add some flavourings, leave that another 7 days to oxygenate, and then you've got your hard booch. It's as simple as that.
How's the sugar content? I'm always obsessed with sugar content.
Well, it's low. It's low. We've deliberately kept it low because we wanted the superfecta. We wanted low calorie, we wanted vegan, we wanted gluten-free, organic, and we wanted seaweed in every can.
I've met John because he did a presentation at the second day of the UCC conference. We did a Dragon's Den style event and he's really good at doing the presentation. But what did he make of you coming down with an idea like this to him?
He thought it was, I remember we brought himself and his wife Val to dinner in Malahide and we pitched it to them. And I suppose he'd been doing Bear Gin maybe for 6 or 7 years at that stage. And he's a shrewd man, and when you present the market opportunity and you kind of say at that stage when we pitched it, nobody in Europe was doing it. We thought we'll steal a march here. And even still, there's an operator, a very small operator, and they're not really making much ground. And he just saw the opportunity and we said, look, we can set up camp down in Castletown Bear or thereabouts. We can, potentially get a bit of grant funding. We know what we're doing in terms of sales and marketing. Nobody else is doing it. First mover advantage. And it's not that hard to do.
The saying that pioneers get shot. Did it not occur to you that the reason that there isn't this drink available in Europe, despite it being so popular in America, is that everyone else has looked at it and went, nah, that's not going to work.
Well, look, there's a first
time.
Sorry,
I don't want to sound negative. I'm just putting these questions to you.
And this is probably something that's wrong with me. In my fabric, I'm an entrepreneur, so I'm a born risk taker. And you win some, you lose some. And it's very difficult to walk away from an opportunity, particularly when you're the first mover. And potentially Guinness and Coca-Cola have looked into this market. It's unlikely they haven't. But potentially it was at the wrong time when they looked into this market. Maybe Ireland wasn't ready for it. But if you think about it sensibly, when we have this thing produced, which is going to be in July there or thereabouts, and we've got, cans of it. In my view, thinking with my salesperson's hat on, all I'll need to do is load up the boot, go down to Barrow Street, open it up and give out a few free samples and they'll go bananas for us. It's a captive market.
Your cars.
You see, I move in the big tech sphere, and I've been into all of these places for talks, into LinkedIn and Google, and there's the free beer fridge in the corner. I'm thinking Combera would look beautiful in that.
That's the name of it now.
It's Combera, yeah. So kombucha, but from Berra.
Very clever. Mm. And will it sell beyond Ireland?
In fairness, we're never going to go to the States because it's a saturated market there. There's an awful lot of very big players there. But in Europe, there's only that one player. So we've got a distribution line into Germany. So really, Ireland will be a test bed. It'll be a bit of a pilot for us. And then
if
we'll expand.
It takes off, will you be able to manufacture all you need down in Barra?
Well, we hope so. There's room for expansion down there. We've got two big units and we think we've got capacity certainly to serve two countries, but we might go beyond that. You never know.
Okay, because you say you're an entrepreneur, and you definitely are, because we're going to talk about lots of different, I mean, there are so different the things that you're involved in, between matchmaking and child protection on the internet, and we'll get to all of those. But radio, you're sitting in front of a mic here inside in the Bar Studios in Marconi House, but you sort of started in radio, didn't you? Although, albeit not behind a microphone, or did you ever get behind the microphone?
No, never got behind the microphone. I'm not talented enough for that, Matt.
I somehow doubt you. I think you're underselling yourself there, Rena.
No, I just do a lot of these. No, I started off in sales. So the first sales job I got, I studied media production in college, and then I wanted to be an editor. And
sorry, what's involved in media production?
So making ads, making movies, making TV shows, all of that kind of thing. It was the then DIT. And I thought I wanted to be a film editor, and graduated, got great results, thought I'd get a job straight away. And I got a job as a runner after tormenting receptionists in about 40 different production companies. And I went in, it was the biggest post-production company in Ireland at the time. And I went in as a runner, I think earning 60 quid a week for like 100 hours work or something like that. And I realized very quickly that if I wanted to move up in the world in there, it would take about 2 years. The last guy before me that had been promoted was there 2 years. And then he was promoted to tape up, which is play and record. And I thought, this is not for me. And I remember...
How disappointing was that? If you had your heart set in it, and why was your heart set in it in the first place?
I don't know. I think I was searching for a vocation. I never got one. You know, I wanted to be a journalist originally, and then I didn't get the points to go to DCU, and that I was gutted. Then I thought, oh, I want to be an architect. And then, you know, wildly
Remind
swinging.
In a lot of different directions.
Yeah, wildly swinging around. And I couldn't land on something. And I remember on day two in that job, we used to have to stand in the kitchen down in the bowels of the building and wait for a phone call. We weren't allowed to sit down. There were six other runners, took a phone call, and they said, can you bring over the Hoover to the other building? So I said, fine. Lumped this big, whatever, Henry or Vax or something across the other building. And I said, where do you want me to leave this? And they said, we don't want you to leave it anywhere. We want you to use it. And I said, this is just not for me. I can't do this for 2 years for 60 quid a week. So I went to my mother and I said, I need to earn money. I'm tired of this. You know, I'm not going to make it as a film editor. I don't have the staying power.
You still living at home?
No, I was still living at home. Yeah, yeah. At the time, I think I was 20. And she said, well, to earn money, you need to be able to do one of two things, produce something or sell. And I said, well, I don't know how to make anything, so I'm going to have to sell. So I applied for...
A wise mother, wasn't she?
She was wise, yeah, very wise. I mean, she was running, she was an office manager in a big post-production a repo house, basically for print. And it was a very successful family business. And she could see all, she was there for 25 years. She could see all these people coming and going. She managed the wages. She knew who earned and who didn't. And she could see that sales was, you know, if you didn't know how to do making things, you could quite easily go in and sell. And so I decided to sell. First job I got was O'Sullivan Graphics. They fired me after 3 months. I think I was coming up to, I don't think I was showing enough promise. I was a bit too nervous at that stage. I didn't have enough confidence. I know it's hard to fathom that I lacked confidence, but I did, it seems. And I think it was a practical reason. I think at that time, they got me from a recruitment agent, and if you were there for longer than 3 months, that triggered the commission. So, you know, I think at 2 months and 29 days, they decided I wasn't going to cut the mustard. So then the lowest point I'd say probably in my early life was going on the dole for about 3 weeks. And I really struggled with it because I had done part-time jobs ever since I was a small kid. Like when I say small kid, I mean 14 during the summer.
Yeah.
And I always understood the value of a book and working and being on time and all that kind of thing. And then when I was fired from that job, I spent a few weeks on the dole, and I think it was Sean McDermott Street I had to go in and queue.
Yes, I know it, yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, I can't do this for any longer. And a friend of mine called me up and she said, 90 FM are looking for salespeople. Send in your CV. And I was like, no, they'll never have me. It'll be awful. I'm terrible. And she said, just do it. So I sent in my CV, and then I did what I'd learned to do trying to get my runner's job. And I started tormenting the receptionist, you know, ringing up, following up. I'm just following up. I sent Michael in my CV. Is anybody going to come back to me? And one day I rang up and a woman answered the phone, and it turned out to be Elaine Geraghty, who you and I will both know from News Talk, and she used to be Pat and Elaine in 98. And she said, I'll take a message. And she got on to Michael, who was the sales manager at the time, and said, I think you should give this girl a go. And I went in and he pointed to a stack of pages on his desk and he said, there's all the CVs I got in. Why should I give you the job? Now, that could have been anything. You know, that could have been Jane Elore books all stacked up and I wouldn't have known, but it was a good ploy. So, you know, I did the whole selling him a pen test and eventually I got the job.
See, a couple of things are interesting there. How important is it when people apply for a job, particularly when they're starting off? And I'm thinking of this with a lot of younger people, that they make an application, they wait to hear something back. They almost now expect the potential employer to chase them, to convince them that they should go to the job. Whereas actually, you've got to actually at times really show how keen and how interested you are.
Look, this is a bugbear of mine. I really feel it's not difficult these days to stand out as an employee. All you need to do is be proactive and show an interest, do a little bit of research and behave like you don't deserve the job. It really isn't difficult. Show up on time, you know, curb your absenteeism, that kind of thing. We learned this actually with Intro. When we were putting job ads up on Indeed, we were getting the spray and pray. Within a few hours, we had a few hundred CVs and we would, and then so Fergal would go through the rigor of looking at these CVs, calling up the relevant people, and they would say, who is this now? Matchmaking? What are you talking about?
But you've applied for the
job. You've applied for the job, you numpty. And you'd be absolutely aghast. 9 out of 10 would say, I don't know what you're talking about. So we ended up, as a criteria, putting deep into the bowels of the job spec, in order to apply, you send in your CV, but also email us at info@intro and tell us why you want to work at Intro. Just a couple of lines. And that whittled it all down. So now we don't call anybody that just sends a CV in. We wait to see if they've read the job application or the job post. And then they've been proactive and sent in a line to say why they want to work at the company.
See, that's cleverer than artificial intelligence, isn't it?
I'm telling you. I should be a consultant.
We'll get to Intro and matchmaking in just a little while, but I'll go back to your radio career. So then you started selling. Mm. And what was that like?
Awful for the first 3 months. And I had a real crisis of confidence and I wasn't doing very well. And I was shadowing, you know, the best of the best, which is the likes of Vanessa Murphy and those guys. And it just wasn't clicking. And at that point, I went to my sales manager and he said, look, stop panicking. Just stop putting pressure on yourself. And I had a chat with Dan Healy, who was the chief executive at the time. And they were like, just calm down. It's fine. And I'll still never forget the nerves of going up to a sales meeting and panicking and thinking, what if they don't want to buy off me? How am I going to explain this? It's in my pipeline in 98. And I'm going to be asked questions at that Tuesday morning meeting at the crack of dawn. So when they told me to just relax, something just clicked and I tipped over. With the tipping point finally happened and I just got it. And any salesperson will tell you, if you're getting close to your target, you can accelerate because the pressure, that subconscious pressure, kind of really eases. And I just started exceeding my targets and then I started getting emails from, you know, the likes of Dennis at the time, you know, you're doing really well, that kind of thing. And then I just reasonably quickly, I'd say I was probably there about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and I was I became direct sales manager, and then it all just went from there. That's how the sales career started.
Okay, twice you've mentioned the word confidence. Mm. So how important is that as well, particularly for women in business? Because this is a discussion that I would have with my three adult daughters in particular as well, about the need to actually project yourself, to show confidence, to be confident about yourself.
I was quite lucky in my childhood. My parents instilled a lot of confidence in me. You know, they very much, anything you want, you can have it if you work hard enough. That was the mantra. And when I went out into the big bad world, I suppose that was challenged a bit. You know, if I got a job in that post-production company, I expected them to see my talent straight away. I expected them to see my confidence. When I went into O'Sullivan Graphics, I expected them to see that I'd be great straight away. And when that didn't kind of happen, it was a bit of a shock, but I was very young. I was 20. Confidence is very, very important. And I regained it over time. But it can be, when it's challenged and when you're young, it is very difficult to overcome knocks like that. But it is simply a question of get up, try again, regain your confidence. And I suppose that the ultimate manifestation of that with women is imposter syndrome. And I think, but having said that, I think men get imposter syndrome as well. I, you know, every new job I've gone into, I've done the process of applying, lots of interviews, you get the job and you forget you've been given the job by people that know better than you, and they see in you a reason with a reasonable degree of confidence that you'll be good at it. But every single job I've gone into, I've thought they're going to find me out. Something's going to happen. I'm going to get found out. But I don't really think that's exclusive to women. I think men get it too.
Some of my closest friends are involved in sales, but I've also come across people in sales who are ridiculous bluffers. Is that a fair assessment to make? And you sort of wonder, how can everyone not be seeing through them? They're extraordinary bluffers.
Yeah, but if someone's going to go through the rigor of really trying hard to bluff you, you kind of almost know, but you go on, I'll buy off you anyway. You've made the effort. You know, I, as a salesperson, I really appreciate that. I love it. In fact, I'm always thinking, how could I hire this person? You know, what job could I give them? Because it's so hard to find a really good salesperson.
Yeah, what makes a good salesperson?
Oh, I've been asked this about the nature and nurture thing before about salespeople, and it's a combination of both, I think. You know, there are natural born salespeople like Vanessa that just, they could buy and sell anything. And then there's learned salespeople. I'm a bit of a combination of both, I would say, because certainly it didn't come naturally to me at the beginning. I'm competitive, and that's what goes in my favour. I don't like to fail. So I think the fact that I don't like to fail drove me to learn the craft more and try harder. Whereas an awful lot of natural born salespeople really don't need to try. They've got that bluff. It's just in them. You know, my husband is like that, Fergal. He's, you know, he's one of the best salespeople, probably the best salesperson I've ever met, because he's never lost his grow for it. I burnt out. You know, by the time I was 30, I'd gone from selling in 98 to sales manager to, and then I moved on to Sky TV. I was selling there as well. Then I moved on to sales director in what's now Sunshine, but I never stopped selling. And then laterally, the last job I had for the man, I was in iRadio. And even though by the time I left, I was chief executive, I was still selling.
Yeah.
But that was a product of need rather than want. I was the most experienced salesperson. It was a startup, effectively.
You needed the revenue.
We needed the revenue. So I was going out doing, you know, in fairness, I was doing the big sales deals, the, you know, the Super Value sponsorships, the Subway sponsorships,
you had the contacts.
That kind of stuff. I had the contacts, but I also, at that time, I had the confidence. And, you know, companies like Super Value, when you go in to sell to them and get a sponsorship across a number of radio stations, you know, 15 counties, they want the chief executive to go in. They don't really want a salesperson to go in. They like, you know, the halo effect,
yeah.
I suppose. So I never stopped selling, but I lost the grow for selling. Whereas Virgil's been doing sales now for over 20 years and he still loves it. He still gets that kick out of closing a deal, whereas I don't. I burnt out of that when I was about 30. I had 10 years in me.
Hold on. You have to be closing deals in the business you're in at present, don't you, the various businesses?
That's a good point. It's sales, but not by, it's not labelled sales. You know, I had to get investors in. We ended up with 13 angel investors in.
So which company now?
This is in Kilter. This is in the
we get to Kilter. We get to Kilter.
It's Chirp now. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I do keep having to sell myself to get thought leadership status in the likes of child protection or to get investors in. It's all sales by a different name, but it's not sign on the dotted line and the panic that they're not going to sell. It's much more passive than that.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Earlier, though, you described yourself correctly as an entrepreneur. So where did the entrepreneurial thing come from, given that the first decade or so of your career was very much working for other people, working for businesses, working your way up to being a chief executive?
Yeah, and I to be honest with you, I always, because I was B2B sales throughout my career, I was dealing with business people all the time, people that have founded their own companies. And I always thought, that is madness. Why would everyone knows in a business, if things aren't going well, the last person to get paid is the founder. You know, when you own the business, you get what's left, you know, before corporation tax. That's how it works, certainly in SMEs. And I thought, that is madness. Imagine having no job security. Imagine having no wage security. Imagine having to look after all of the bills and all of the staff first before you get a penny. And I was thinking about my mortgages and how do I pay for this. I thought it was insanity. And something just changed. I mean, when we started iRadio, I 102 104 launched in 2008. And shortly thereafter, I 105 107 launched. And you'll remember the 2008, 2009
what
selling advertising.
Like in it's like COVID. We tried to blank that period of
Yeah. We've all got PTSD. Yeah. Certainly in 2005, I wasn't involved in the writing of the applications and the submissions to the IBI, the BAI for those licenses. But they were constructed around 2005, 2006, because they take a long time to process. And in 2005, really all you needed to do was open the window and money flew in. I mean, I remember a time in 98 and Sky where you sold out of your advertising because there was limits. You know, your inventory is limited to about 10 minutes an hour there or thereabouts. I don't know whether that's still true or not.
12.
And 12, 12 now, is it right? And then sponsorship taglines aren't included in that 12 minutes, right? So your inventory was limited. And at points, we had waiting lists. You know, and principally, certainly in direct sales, you were getting, you couldn't have two housing developers in one ad break. So they were waiting lists and they wanted to spend tens of thousands because they were going to the Irish Times and they were paying, say, 30 grand for a full page ad, whereas they were coming to 98 and for 30 grand, they were getting a full month of advertising, you know, an ad every hour in prime time. You know, they just saw the value and there were waiting lists. And that was 2005. So these applications, these license applications were done around then. And they were sold to investors, rightly so. There was no trickery. Rightly so. Here's what you can expect in terms of your return on investment. And then, and we were getting as close as damn it to rate cards. And a rate card basically is the recommended retail price for people that don't know radio. And usually there's a small discount off that. But when we got to, it's a point at which you jump off and start discounting. But then when we got to 2008 and 2009, rate cards were thrown out the window. I mean, at one point, I remember in 2010 and 11 when we started Intro, and I was going to my friends in radio. A, I wanted to support them, but B, I could see I was going to get a good deal. And we were paying 10% on rate cards. That's how decimated...
For the airtime. Business, yeah.
And that's how decimated radio was at that stage. Because the first thing that gets cut from a budget is marketing, because it's seen as a necessary evil. It's not tangible. You can't, you know, and this is one of the things I always say, if you can sell advertising, you can sell anything because you're basically selling a dream. It's nothing. You know, you're saying to a guy that owns a car garage, give me $5,000 and I'll get you X amount of ads. And he says, and how many customers is that going to get me? You go, well, I'll give you the listened yesterday figures and I'll give you the average quarter hour and I'll give you an estimate of how many people are going to hear it, but I can't give you conversion figures. And around that time as well, radio was struggling with analytics. So you were being eaten alive, were starting to be eaten alive by the likes of Google, YouTube, Facebook, who were coming in and able to give those conversion rates. They were able to say, here's how many click-throughs you got, here's how many people submitted a contact form. So, you know, Joe Bloggs, who owns a car dealership, could see that his €1,000 was getting him 10 conversions, whereas we were kind of going, well, that's great for your brand. So it was very different in 2008 and 2009. And going back to your original question, why did I decide to be an entrepreneur? Things were going so badly in radio and advertising in generally. And I always thought I would stick with radio. But I never saw that things would go so badly. And it was very difficult to hit targets, practically impossible. And doing board meetings once a month with investors who had invested on the basis of 2005 revenue projections they're sensible people, their own businesses were suffering, but they were putting the squeeze on everybody externally to try and get a return on their investment. And there's no amount of coercion or convincing could make the money come in because the money wasn't there. Those budgets were all being hammered. And all of these businesses that we were selling to battened down the hatches and just went into survival mode. So it was what needs to be paid. And that's it. And marketing didn't need to be paid for.
So you got out.
Yeah. Before I left, Fergal and I came up with this idea for the matchmaking company. We're in Gibney's and Malahide. And I knew I wanted to get out. And I knew a sidestep into TV wasn't going to make any difference. A sidestep into press wasn't going to make any difference. Everybody was dying in media. And Fergal was working in property sales. So that was dying.
Wasn't good. Yeah.
So both of us were like, I hate my industry. Do you hate your industry? Oh, yeah, me too.
And then was more and more drink being consumed as you were thinking?
Possibly while we were in Gibney's, yeah. And so...
If only you'd had hard kombuchas at the time.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So we were in Gibney's one night and I saw this guy, and it was a friend of mine's birthday, and I saw him go to the bar and had a drink, and he was standing beside the wall with his pint. And I noticed again later he was still there. So I kept an eye on him and I was like, what's he doing? He was he's early 40s, I would say. And then I realised, oh my God, he's after coming here on his own to try and meet somebody. And it was a Saturday night. Now, if you know Gibney's, you don't go to Gibney's on a Saturday night and, you know, and sit at the pint. Like, it's perfectly fine to sit in a bar on your own, but on a Saturday night in a place like Gibney's. And I thought, oh my God, and I felt so sorry for him. And I thought, I've got about 20 girlfriends that would be delighted to date this guy. What is going wrong in the dating scene that this guy feels the need that he has to come to this place on his own? And I thought, matchmaking. You know, I could set him up with a friend of mine, but I could make him pay.
Hold on.
And no, I could make them pay.
I'm trying to work out the years here. Were there not Tinder and things like that at this stage become very popular?
Not that popular at that time.
No, because it was probably even before you really had everyone with smartphones been able to swipe left or right or whatever.
Correct.
Should you do?
I remember at the time, you know, you had the likes of, I think, eHarmony, you had Match.com. You're a bit clunky, wasn't as kind of accessible as it is now. And I was thinking there's a yearning for going back to traditional matchmaking, you know, and for people that wanted to be private. They didn't want to put their face up for all to see. You know, they didn't want... At that time, there was still a bit of a stigma, and there still is a stigma around dating and admitting that you want to meet somebody. You know, a lot of people that are on their own would say, no, I'm really happy being on my own. And you kind of go, okay, that's fine. But an awful lot of people aren't happy being on their own. But they don't want to broadcast that.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't want to be on an app where people can kind of judge. And let's face it, an awful lot of these apps, and even back in the day, online dating sites, it was reduced to how good are you at getting a good picture taken. And that's how you got...
Yeah.
You know, your matches. So we looked into it, and there was an organization called It's Just Lunch at the time, and they had just wrapped up in Ireland. It was a franchise and a very similar model to what we wanted to do. And that was they were doing photographs. We didn't want to do photographs. We wanted to be the antithesis of the likes of an eHarmony or an Elite Singles, that kind of thing. And we just started it, and it was the best time we could have picked to start a business. Advertising was next to nothing. We got rent for next to nothing. Everything was next to nothing. And you had your pick of employees. So we started the business.
Apart from those time. Ones who don't read on through your job.
Yeah, exactly. So we started the business, and it was in our part-time. So I was doing it at weekends and nighttime, and we kept our full-time jobs. And then very quickly, it was able to sustain both of us full-time.
And how many people would go through the books in a year?
Oh God, that's a good question. At any given time, there's live about over 1,000 people.
Because you're doing this now 12 or 13 years.
Yeah. It's
and Fergal's still very into it.
He loves it.
I know this from having spoken to him.
Yeah. He loves it. He said, now when you go into Matt now, tell him that I want to do a podcast with him. I want to talk specifically about matchmaking.
Yeah, but you see, this is the 21st century matchmaking. Are you a bit like the old fellas down in Clare and the rest of it, finding the farmers to find a bride that they can actually then have the inheritance moves on to somebody else? Or has it gone beyond that?
It's gone a bit beyond that. I mean, look, we still get the 65-year-old guys ringing us and saying, oh, now my folks have finally died. I want to find myself a woman so I can have a baby and pass on the farm to. And Fergal's going, why did you leave it until you're 65? Well, I wanted to wait until the folks passed away. I was looking after them.
That still happens.
And it's just not realistic. You know, gone are the dowry days, you know. So unfortunately, Fergal still has to be the bearer of bad news to some of these guys and say, look, we can definitely set you up, but you're going to need to be realistic on age.
Yeah, because Fergal was saying to me that for all the applications that you have, a good many of them you don't take on. You actually have to nicely, because you're letting people down and they might be upset by it, but you actually have to say, look, we don't think we can actually offer you a service.
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, we took everyone on because we thought their ask was realistic.
Just naive on your part?
It was naive on our part. And we very quickly started to realise, we were like, why are all these women in Dublin and all the men are down the country? Now, I'm generalising now. And why are there all these professional women? There's all these guys in trades and farming. And so I started to look into the CSO to see what was going on. And I remember looking at it at that time. And for every one professional woman, there was 0.6 of a professional man. Because women stay longer on education and tend to do slightly better than men do, which means that women are drawn towards cities to professional jobs and the men are staying in trades and farming down the country, in large part.
Yeah.
And that was skewing the numbers. So we had to learn that if a woman is in a city and not prepared to travel, or if a man is in the countryside and not prepared to travel, then we can't take them on. Because for every one professional woman, there was distance. And there was issues around profession. So if the professional woman was coming to us and saying, well, I want a professional man, and we were saying, well, your one-to-one doesn't exist. And they were saying, well, this is what I want. And we're saying, okay, but that's what every professional woman wants. So we can't favour you over everybody else. It wouldn't be fair. So we just developed these policies that you have to be willing to travel up to 90 minutes to meet an equidistant point. You have to be willing to not be matched based on profession. And you need to be realistic on age, because we were getting the 65-year-old guy coming saying, I'd love a 35-year-old woman. We're saying, well, that's fine. You can have what you want, but 35-year-old women only want men that are in their 30s. You know, so you're competing with men that are in their 30s. Why would they go for you? So we needed to implement these policies to make sure that we were taking on people that we could please, because we knew in the end, there's no point in taking on people you can't please.
Do you arrange the dates then, or what do you do? Do you arrange a panel of certain for people that they can get in contact with? Well, how does it work?
Yeah, so we pick the date. So we're basically saying to people, you don't get a photograph, we'll call you when we've got what we believe is a suitable match. We'll call you, we'll walk through the profile over the phone. If you're interested in meeting that person, if they're interested in meeting you, then we organise the date.
So you arrange the restaurant?
Mm-hmm. We arrange everything. So they just then go to the restaurant, they say there's a table booked under X name, and they meet, and they have their date. The reason we go for a restaurant, it's a few reasons. We go for security. It's very easy if you organise a coffee date. And this is what happens with Tinder dates, the spray and pray approach. You go in, you take one look at the cover, I don't fancy you, and have a quick gulp down of a cappuccino and then leg it. Dating is hard work. You have to sit there and look beyond the cover and get to know a person. And if you're sitting there for a meal and you're not prepared to put the hard work in, it's a very awkward hour and a half. So it forces people into making a bit of an effort. And you'd be absolutely staggered the difference that makes. So it's for a number of reasons that we go for the meal. That makes some people uncomfortable and we just say, we're not the service for you.
Okay, what if it doesn't work out at the meal? And I'm also thinking, even for, you mentioned for security issues, what if things go wrong in relation to maybe assault or something like that? Where do you stand, given that you have introduced the people?
It's a good question. It hasn't happened. But what we do is, you know, obviously we can't provide any guarantees.
Yeah.
You know, we can't establish whether someone has ever been convicted of a criminal offence, for instance. We rely upon them to be honest with us because we ask them to sign terms and conditions.
You can't do guard vetting.
No, because, I mean, that's a 6-month process.
Yeah.
You can only do it if you're working with children or, you know, vulnerable people. It's not open. It's not an option that's open to us. We check everybody's ID. We check everyone's either passport or driver's licence. We look for everybody's home address. We endeavour to make sure that there are preventative measures in there. So, for instance, if you go out and your intention is usually to attack a woman, for example, you're far less likely to do it knowing that Intro knows exactly where you are because we've organised your date. We know where you live. We know exactly who you are, that you are who you say you are because we've checked your ID and you've signed these terms and conditions. You're less likely to do it, but there can never be a guarantee. But touch wood, it hasn't been an issue up until now. But all we can do is apply best efforts.
But if a meeting doesn't work out, do people come back and complain to you? You set me up with such and such. How dare you set me up? That person was totally inappropriate. I'm not paying my fee to you.
More often than not, Matt, you see, we give people 5 introductions.
Okay.
And we point that out to them. We say, we know we may not get it right within one. So there's 5 opportunities here. Now, we listed the person's attributes to you over the phone. We said, here's why we think you're a good match. They like doing this. They like doing that. You've similar lifestyles. You've similar family backgrounds, goals, all that kind of thing. And you've chosen. You could have said no, But ultimately what that means is if they come back and say, how dare you send me out with that person, it means that they think they weren't a good physical match. And they don't like that. They don't like the fact that, you know, five people in the intro office have agreed that this is a good match and you're appropriate for him and he's appropriate for you. And they're kind of going, oh, maybe what I'm looking at in the mirror isn't quite what everybody else is seeing. And they're thinking, how dare you? If you peel it all back, that's ultimately what it's down to if somebody behaves that way.
But clearly the business has gone well if you're still going 13 years after setting it up.
Growing year on year, thank goodness, touch wood. You know, it is a good business. It is a really good business. It's highs and lows.
But you're not spending much time with it, are you?
I don't spend any time with it, to be honest with
you. Why not?
It's all Fergal. Well, I'm busy with it. I've got into technology now, Matt.
Yes. Tell us about this. How and why did you get into the tech side?
It was around 2015, 2016, I started having my kids. And in truth, intro at that time had been all I was doing for 4 or 5 years. And I was a bit bored. I wasn't really being challenged. You know, Fergal still gets the grow from the sales and bringing in the money and all that kind of thing. But
you had become a bit
It was very process. Yeah, it was very, yeah, that was it. So I was lacking challenge. So started at having my kids and...
So how many do you have?
Two. They're 7 and 9 now, Quinn and Darcy. And so when I started having my kids, it was around the time I kept getting sort of the image of Alan Kurdi. Do you remember the little Syrian boy that washed up on the beach in Turkey?
Three and a half years of age.
Yeah. And very harrowing image. I kept crying because I was very emotional at the time. And I looked around for a filter on Facebook and Twitter so I could keep using social media without being served as image, very selfishly. But I couldn't find one. So I asked some friends and they said, no, I don't know of a filter. But if you find one, let me know because I'm always getting served images and stories I don't want to see. And it still happens. You know, you wake up in the morning, you get an Irish Times notification. You go, I didn't need to see that headline in my day, you know, about a child being abused or whatever. And so I kind of left that be. And then when I had my kids, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a technologist and he said, look, what you're not talking about is a really natural fit for a parental control. I became interested in parental controls because when I had my kids, my perspective changed entirely and all I could see were headlines of kids that had been systematically cyberbullied, groomed, coerced and pushed into suicide. And the one common thread was the parents didn't know there was anything wrong until it was too late for them to do anything. And so I took a look back at that filter idea. My friend Jules, who is a technologist and is now working with us in Chirp, formerly Kilter, we've rebranded. He said, you know, why don't you take a deep dive into the parental control market and see what's there? So I did. And I found that all that was available to parents when they gave their child a smartphone. So outside the house, you know, there's an awful lot of solutions, you know, blocking pornography URLs, that kind of thing when they're inside the house. But when you send them out into the wild, there was nothing. So what was there were parental control apps. Now, there was about 250 parental control apps on the Google Play Store, about 220 on the Apple Store. And they all shared a variety of features. They all had access restriction and monitoring to stop your child becoming addicted to their phone. They had pornography and gambling blocking. They had geofencing and geo-tracking, so you could find your child if they had their phone on them. But none of them were dealing with cyberbullying and grooming. I mean, so a few of them were kind of saying that they specialised in dealing with cyberbullying and grooming. But when you looked under the hood, what they were really just doing was kind of tracking contacts as opposed to tracking content. So the only way that you can deal with cyberbullying and grooming is being able to look inside messaging apps because that is where cyberbullying and grooming generally happens. And also look at browser searches.
This could be even sort of kids who are at school with each other. It's things on WhatsApp
groups. WhatsApp groups.
Or whatever.
Correct.
Making a mockery of a child or bullying a child.
Yes. Yeah. And then if you look at the grooming side, generally the way groomers tend to behave is they will contact a child on an open platform such as their public Facebook page or a forum. And then they'll very quickly try and invite the child into an encrypted app out of the reach of scrutiny of any sort of filters that are online. And then you have no visibility at all. So nobody was dealing with cyberbullying and grooming. And I was thinking, with my salesperson's hat on, surely there's a need for this. And there was a web-wide study that had been done actually by the Irish government at the time, November 17, I think. And it assessed parents' main concerns while they gave their child a smartphone. There was 4 main equal concerns. So parents were afraid their child would spend too much time online, be groomed, be cyberbullied, or access pornography. So the pornography and the access restriction were being super served by the app stores, but nobody was dealing with cyberbullying and grooming. And I thought, why is nobody doing this? It's very, very obvious. It's not just me. There's a need for this. So I started to teach myself about the technology and speak to some lecturers and all that kind of thing about it and realised nobody was doing it because it's hard. And when I say hard, I mean if you were to tackle cyberbullying and grooming, you need to access messaging apps. Now, apps operate on a peer-to-peer system. So you can download all of the best in show of the parental control apps that are available on the app stores, but they'll sit at the same permissions layer as Snapchat, TikTok, WhatsApp, Telegram. So they can never access data within those other apps. So an application will never be able to deal with cyberbullying and grooming because they lack the technology to access messaging apps. So the earliest point in the technological stack that you can access all incoming and outgoing data, including in encrypted apps, is the kernel level. So it needs to be embedded technology. So you need to have an agreement with a smartphone manufacturer to embed your technology at point of manufacture. And that's the reason no independent company was doing it, because you effectively hand over your autonomy. All of the parental control apps are B2C. They're business to consumer. They can launch, they can spend $500,000 developing their app, launch it to the app store, sell to consumers, use that revenue to develop incremental improvements into their app. But they've got autonomy. They can sell to consumers. Whereas if you were to tackle cyberbullying and grooming, you rely upon that channel and doing a deal with an OEM and selling B2B.
So an OEM being an original equipment
manufacturer. Yeah, so a smartphone manufacturer. So the advice at the time was don't do it, but we decided to do it anyway. And so it was, you know, we took another bit of advice.
You've explained that brilliantly, but you're still not a technologist, because there's a massive difference, isn't there, in having to be a coder or whatever it is to actually write the programs to do what you've described as needed.
Yeah, and thankfully there are many, many other technologists out there that I could partner with and hire that can do all this for me. I can understand it at a top line layer. I mean, looking at code, I look at our team. We've got 16 in the team, and I look at what they're doing, and it's like looking into a bush. I don't understand any of it. I always tell them, treat me like I'm a smart toddler, because I need to be able to understand this, because I go out there into the world and I talk on the Matt Cooper podcast about it. So I need to be able to articulate it in a way. But no, I didn't understand it, but I have a reasonably logical brain. So when somebody sits down and gives me the ladybird version, I can get it and I can regurgitate it. And that's all that's really required. So it was a very steep learning curve, I won't lie. And there was a lot of conversations that needed to be had, a lot of articles that needed to be read to become familiar with all this. And I did it by osmosis over the last 6 years and just kind of, but I still could never
code. You moved slowly, haven't you?
Yeah. It took a long time to get funding. I mean, it's deep tech. So we knew.
What does deep tech mean?
Yeah. So it's kernel level. It's operating system. It's disruptive technology. So you can't just code an app, develop an app at that layer. And in fairness, it's very difficult to have protectable IP when you develop an app. You know, really what you need to be doing is developing a novel process that has never been done before in technological advancement to get a patent, for example. And if you want, certainly if you want to get investment from the likes of the states, that kind of thing, you need a patent portfolio. So we were starting off well. The advice was patent first, build later, protect yourself. And that was for a number of reasons. You can't have conversations with Samsung and Oppo and Huawei unless you've got a patent, because they just won't talk to you because they'll be afraid you'll accuse them of stealing your IP. So in order to open up those doors, in order to open up doors with investors and demonstrate to them, I've got a patent, there's something here, it's a novel step, it's a bona fide disruptive invention, you know, it made sense to get the patent through. So Fergal and I had a discussion. We decided to invest in the startup and just have a go at it. And so we threw all of our savings at it. We spent about 150 grand. So we just, you know, in fairness to him, he took a big gamble on investing in me and kind of, you know, hoping I'd learn technology and be able to make a go of it. So look, we took a bit of a step into the breach and we got the patent granted. We started the process of looking for funding. We knew early doors, we put the plan together and we knew it would cost us about 4 million to get to market. And that's very, like, that's a fruity raise anywhere in the world. In Ireland, it's virtually impossible. If I had a euro for every time someone said, oh, you need 4 million, what could you get to market for 400,000? I'd be like, nothing, dude. I can't get anything to market for 400,000. That's application layer. This is deep tech. So we knew that we'd need to de-risk it with some public money. So we started the process of applying for H2020 funding, with H2020 back then. So it's the European Commission grant process. It's an enormous fund, a couple of billion or something like that. But at the time, it has a statistical success rate of anywhere between 1% and 4%. I think it's 4% now. At the time, it was lower. And we started writing applications. Every application we did, it took about 4 person months, worked with a consultant to do that. And over the course of that process, I learned how to write grant applications. And we always got extremely close, but no cigar. And then we ended up applying for what is the Disruptive Technology Innovation Fund here. Now, it's the kind of the Irish version. The application process was very, very similar, but you had to have a consortium. But over the course of the, you know, 3 or 4 years that I had spent writing applications and developing my knowledge base and building up stakeholder support and endorsement, we had developed really good relationships with DCU, specifically the Anti-Bullying Research Centre. And they had written us a lovely letter of support. We'd gotten a letter of support from Vodafone. We had all these letters of support from the likes of Barry Lowry, the CIO of the government. A lot of support and goodwill. So by the time it came around to applying for the DTIF, we had a natural-born hand-in-glove partner in DCU because the Anti-Bullying Research Centre was there. And we partnered with Amoric Market Research as well to help us with the data sets. So we applied in Call 3, didn't get it, and got it in Call 4.
So where are you at now? Because you've changed the name recently to Chirp.
Yeah.
Why so? Does that signify that you're getting somewhere, that you needed to change the name?
Yeah, I got an email on... you see, I came up with Kilter back when I was, you know, it was back of envelope kind of stuff. I was looking for something that I could get in terms of a .com. I was looking to make up a word, you know, that old, you know, chestnut, make up a word, have ownership, blah, blah, blah. So I came up with the word Kilter for content filter and it just seemed to fit. I got the .com, thought I was very proud of myself. On the back of an envelope, I basically, you know, wrote or designed a logo and got somebody, I think, on Fiverr.com to put it together. And it was just so that we would have a logo for putting on grant applications. If you want to put grant applications together, you need to have some sort of brand. So that was it. So we got all this through and I became quite attached to it. But I always knew there was an issue with it because 50% of people say Silter and 50% say Kilter. So it always used to agitate me. But I knew in my heart of hearts I had an ugly baby. And I needed to address it. And in February, I got an email. I've got this amazing advisor. His name is Ronan Dunn. He used to be the chief executive of Verizon. And he introduced me to the head of Android. And I got an email from that said head of Android. He was on his way over to MWC and he was saying, I'm looking at your website. And I was mortified. I was thinking, oh, God damn. It's a bit of a turd, you know. It was a placeholder that was set up 4 years ago and it was all dark and red and scary and techy and, you know, it just wasn't fit for purpose because in fairness, we had paid no attention to it because there was no consumers being directed to it. It was just a place where people could learn about the team and see the demo in action. And I remember going, oh, God, right, okay. And I thought, we've got a bit of money. You know, we'd saved a bit of money at the start of the project and we said, we'll do a bit of investment in the brand and spoke to a few design houses. And the dream was Image Now, Daryl Kavanagh in Image Now. And I spoke to him and I was like, don't rub it in, do me a deal, as always looking for a deal. And he gave me a deal and gave us this amazing team and did a number of workshops. And look, we were looking for something that was the opposite of Kilter. We wanted something that was universal in terms of its pronunciation. We wanted a friendly brand, something that would lend itself to a sonic because we'll be sending notifications to parents on their phones. So we wanted a sonic that would work for a notification and a cross brand. I remember going into Huawei years ago and Eric Collins said, oh, yeah, no, I get you. We were introducing Kilter to them. They said, no, we get you. Yeah, we see Kilter being to parental controls what Intel is to processors. And I was like, I'm going to use that. And it just resonated with me that the Sonic was going to be really important. So we wanted a nice, friendly brand. We wanted to, and we were looking at reviews of parental control apps online in preparation for all of this. And overwhelmingly, they were flooded with children doing reviews of parental control apps saying, don't do this, don't use this product. It's ruined my relationship with my family. And one of the reasons why we had gotten endorsement from Professor James O'Higgins-Norman, who is the UNESCO Chair for the Prevention of Bullying in Schools and Cyberspace, is because what we wanted to achieve was not spying. We wanted to involve the child in their own online safety because all of the research, all the child protection stakeholders would say, don't restrict access, don't spy on your child. They'll find out. And they'll go and buy a secret phone and then you won't know about it and you'll have no visibility at all. So we want to reduce familial friction around smartphone use. We were talking to parents and we could already see anecdotally from talking to our own friends that there was friction around smartphone use. You know, parent would finally give in, okay, have your phone, but you're having it for half an hour a day and I have to be able to look at it any time. But as soon as the child gets it and gets a flavour of autonomy and independence, they want to stretch that. It's natural for children to do it. So we didn't want to spy on kids. We wanted to involve kids in their own online safety. So we wanted a brand that would be accessible to kids, accessible to parents, and reduce that familial friction. And I think we got there with Chirp.
So where's it at now?
So we got the DTIP funding and the project for a two-year project. So it's a development runway of 2 years. And we're a year in now. So we started on the 1st of May last year. And we're meeting all of our deliverables and milestones and all that kind of stuff. So my job now is, well, we've got our development team there in DCU Alpha. My job now is to nail down pilot partners to do our pilot with us in Ireland, in the wild, in about 9 months' time. And we're talking to the big smartphone manufacturers and the big tier one telcos about that. So that's my next sales job, Matt. That's my big sales challenge.
Just to finish up, and I'm not going to ask you about your role in the Commission on Taxation because it just strikes me that that would be boring by comparison to all things that we've just spoken about.
It definitely wasn't boring.
Or was it not?
No.
How did you get into that?
To be honest with you, I don't know. I think maybe Áine Kerr maybe recommended me to the minister who was at the time, Pascal Donoghue, and I think Ian Keogh, because I was working with Ian. I write a bit for The Currency. Yeah. And I just got an email one day from the secretariat inviting me and saying the minister would like to invite you onto the Commission on Taxation and Welfare. I think it's because it was a very varied commission, but I was on there to represent technology startups because we're often in the news in terms of EIIS. And there's a lot of lobbying from the likes of Scale Ireland, but also as the owner of a small enterprise being Intro, that I could speak to both of those challenges and how, because the terms of reference were very vast. You know, they went from housing to health and then how do we support entrepreneurship in Ireland. I think I was on there to meet that kind of that remit. It was to speak to how taxation policy can be used to influence that.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you any more about that. I'm going to finish though by asking you, would you fear that for Intro that artificial intelligence is going to take over and that's how the matches will be made in the future?
Well, actually, no. Every conference I go to, it's AI. I'm trying to figure out the eureka moment where we can figure out how we can use internally AI to improve our processes. But because our USP is that person-to-person thing, it's the opposite of the AI. I think Intro will survive because it's unique. But I'd like to be able to leverage AI to improve our productivity and processes.
Rina, it's been terrific having you here on Magnified. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. Hope you enjoyed it. Loads of other interviews that you can go back and listen to in the series. So if you've liked this, why don't you recommend it to a friend, wherever it is you're listening to it, be it on the Go Loud app or Apple or Spotify or wherever it is. And again, big thanks to our sponsors, Volkswagen Financial Service Business Leasing, regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland, without whom this podcast would not have been made. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you very much for having joined us.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.